Our guest this week is a bright man recently introduced to millions of Americans when he served as the opening and youngest speaker at the recent Republican National Convention. At 26 years of age, and having been named to the Forbes 30 Under 30 list, he's already a force to be reckoned with in American politics. Regardless of one's personal partisan leanings, this fellow commands respect for his ability to articulate a compelling case for traditional conservative ideology. He's the founder and president of Turning Point USA, a national student movement dedicated to identifying, organizing, and empowering young people to promote the principles of free markets and limited government, which are, at least, are supposed to be, the foundation of American conservative thinking. With a presence in over 2,000 high school and college campuses nationwide, 250,000 student members, and over 150 full-time staff, Turning Point USA is the largest and fastest-growing conservative youth activist organization in the country. He's a New York Times best-selling author whose presence on social media reaches over 100 million people per month, and according to Axios, he's one of the top 10 most engaged Twitter handles in the world, behind only President Trump among conservatives. And now he's joined the ranks of radio talk show hosts, launching a brand new daily show heard middays on the Salem Radio Network. Our guest this week is Charlie Kirk. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. And if you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with the founder of Turning Point USA and host of a new midday show on the Salem Radio Network, Charlie Kirk. Charlie, congratulations. You got yourself a national talk show on the Salem Radio Network all across the country. At the time we're doing this conversation, it's been on for just basically a couple of days. How's it feel? How's it going?
It's been incredible. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a new medium for us in some ways. We've been doing podcasting for a year and a half, and we started ramping up doing two podcasts a day in early June, as soon as the BLM movement kind of started to bubble up, if you will. And yeah, all throughout the summer, we were doing two podcasts a day and one on Saturday and Sunday. And we were in conversations with Salem, and now it has officially resulted into 2 hours of live national radio a day. And we're still doing the podcast space, but it's phenomenal. We are so thankful to the Salem Radio Network for partnering and for Phil Boyce. And we think that, you know, hopefully our goal is just to be better every single day, just kind of listening to yesterday's show and seeing what did well and what didn't do so well and how we can continue to improve.
So you've been on talk radio, obviously, as a guest, and you've done a heck of a lot of television. But hosting a show, is this new for you? Have you ever done any kind of radio shows where you're on for 3 hours before?
Well, I filled in many times for Sebastian Gorka and for Dennis Prager and for a couple other hosts, but this is the first time really anchoring a show. Doing podcasting is different because you can edit it and you can do it on your own time. Whether you're having a good day or a bad day or you're feeling good, the thing about radio is you got to go and you're on. And that's kind of the magic of radio, is it's the specific time slot, and you can kind of, you know, you have to make sure that, you know, you're making convincing arguments and exciting people. But no, kind of just new into this space, and the kind of show we're doing is almost no guests. We will have a day where people call in just because the time goes so quick, and we're going to have all of our guest interviews on our podcast format. That's what that will kind of be for. And also the podcast will still have some unique content every single day and a couple times a week as well. So honored to be doing this, and just our goal is to continue to learn and hopefully be better each day.
Yeah, repurposing material is a very productive way to get through multi-platform media these days, to be able to repurpose things for either a podcast or a live show or any number of other media, and who knows what's yet to come. I understand, I don't know if it's true, but I think I heard somewhere that you always were fascinated by radio when you were a kid, which, being as young as you are, wasn't that many years ago. It may seem like a long time ago to you, but to people who've been around the business for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years longer than you, you're starting out. Did you have a fascination for radio growing up? Was that something you wanted to do?
Always have. That is exactly right. Yeah, I mean, look, I grew up listening to talk radio. Grew up listening to Hannity and Levin and Rush, specifically on AM 560, The Answer in Chicago, the Salem equivalent, and also the Rush station in Chicago. And, you know, being a high schooler who was a conservative in a predominantly liberal environment, this was before podcasting. This is before YouTube shows. Think about this. This is before all those things used to exist. And the Fox lineup was pretty good, but what were you supposed to listen to during the day? And the only thing I had was Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and talk radio. And so I've always loved the medium. I like radio because it's exciting, because you know it's live, or at least you know when they said it was live, right? So there's an excitement about that, even if it's rebroadcast at a different time slot.
Right.
And you know it's pertinent. It's much more conversational. It's a lot less formal. It's a lot less scripted. And so I've always enjoyed talk radio. And I think that, you know, it's kind of fitting that now, almost 9 years later, post the forming of Turning Point USA, we're in a position now to be in this space. So we're very thankful for that.
You were, when you were a kid, did you also like music? Were you a music radio fan? Did you like pop culture? What type of a kid were you?
Well, I was very involved in sports growing up, Eagle Scout, football, basketball captain, heavily involved in every activity you can imagine. And so, yeah, and I was involved in, many sorts of, musical endeavors too, musical instruments, clarinet, saxophone, piano, you name it. So, just whatever the activity is, I try to do it. The cool thing about what I get to do now is I get to actually focus on one or two things, where many years ago I had to run so many different parts of our organization and what we do here. So now I get to focus on radio and podcasting, still very involved with Turning Point, what we're doing here and building this organization. And it's a phenomenal blessing to be part of all of it.
Now, Turning Point USA grew to rather large proportions in terms of actual numbers, and it obviously has a tremendous presence on the Internet. How did that come about? How did you suddenly decide to start an organization of other like-minded young people?
Yeah, that's really how I got my start in politics. I started it in June of 2012 because I just believed that young people were not correctly articulating conservative ideas. I felt that students and young people were just being propagandized by the left. And what we've done at Turning Point USA has really changed the entire conservative landscape of how young people interact with these ideas in high school and college campuses. We've been doing it for almost nine years now. It'll be 9 years in June. We just celebrated our eight-year anniversary, and it's been an incredible thing. It really has, to see now Turning Point USA have millions and millions and millions of followers and tens of millions of impressions every single day and week on digital social media. We're on pace to hit 1,000 certified, organized, and recognized chapters across the country, with a presence of over 2,000 high school and college campuses across the country, and well over 160 people on staff. And we're just getting started. Turning Point USA, and we also have Turning Point Action, our political arm, our 501c4 organization. We keep those very separate. And Turning Point Action runs Students for Trump, over 350 Students for Trump chapters across the country that focuses primarily, of course, on getting the president reelected for four more years. So not a lot of time to stay idle. We believe that it's time for patriotic Americans to get further involved to save our country.
Now, you use the word we, and I'm fascinated by organizations and the evolution a person goes through, being a founder and then having the organization grow to a point where it has to have the we factor as opposed to the I factor. How are you running this thing at this point? Are you in control of it? Do you have people doing it for you? What do you mean by we?
We have 160 people on staff and an entire C-level organization of chief operational officers and chief financial officers and board of directors, and about a $31 million operating budget on the 501c3 side, and then about $5 million on the 501c4 side. But, yeah, still very much involved. I don't manage a lot of the day-to-day personnel. management, but try to set big picture aims and goals. I wish I could take credit for all the success of the organization, but I won't because it wouldn't be true. It's Tyler Boyer. It's our amazing team here at Turning Point USA. It's Bill Montgomery, who passed away this summer, played a huge role into the formation and the advancement of our organization. So I just play a small piece here of just trying to keep the energy going and trying to keep the picture focused on big ideas and help a lot with raising capital. But now we have a really good team that helps and focuses on that. So just remarkably blessed, to be honest with you, to just see the incredible amount of energy that this organization has. And, you know, started it from my parents' garage, and now it's a little bit bigger than that. Praise God.
That's it's tremendous, and it's very gratifying and encouraging to see somebody like you enjoy success and maintain that gratitude, because gratitude, I think, is a very important quality to have in going through this thing called life. What happened in your youth? You know, it's unusual, as you mentioned. You thought young people have to learn about conservative values and the tenets of conservatism and how it relates to the country, et cetera, patriotism, and on and on. Were there any, aside from listening to Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, were there any events in your life, or do you remember any kind of turning point in your own life that led to you suddenly saying, hey, I'm a kid that is interested in politics, and on top of that, I believe in conservative values. How'd you come to that?
I also want to add Glenn Beck and Mark Levin and Dennis Prager to that list. But yes, look, I always loved my country, and my parents raised me that way. My parents are center-right conservatives, but they are not by any means political in nature, but they are patriots. They don't tolerate anyone talking poorly about our country. And look, we on the Kirk side, we have been in this country since 1620. We have served in the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War I, World War II. And when I say we, I just mean my family that I come from. And so it's a patriotic family. And so my father raised me to really appreciate the hero's journey that our country has been on through these many generations and how far we've come and why we should be thankful, not angry, that we live in our country. And so that all kind of came to a head when I started being introduced at a young age in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade in public education of the venom that people have for our country, the ingratitude, the nastiness, the bitterness. And I was clumsily trying to defend our country, but I tried my best anyway. And now in high school, that really started to materialize when I started to see far left-wing instructors have so much resentment for our country that they'd tried to impart it on other young people. And so just being a little bit disagreeable by nature, that kind of just translated into politics. So it started with patriotism and it turned into politics. And
are
then
you folks,
by the time I was a junior, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I want to hear the rest. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay. By the time I was a junior and senior in high school, I was being very involved in state and local races in Illinois. And then by the time I was a senior in high school, I wanted to go to West Point, didn't get in, and my rejection from West Point ended up being one of the best things that actually never happened to me, meaning me not getting into West Point.
Right.
And from that point forward, I started Turning Point USA, never went to college, and it's been an incredible journey.
That's amazing. Are your folks still with us? Are they still alive?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much so, yeah. Still live in the suburbs of Chicago, still working. They're doing great.
Are they outrageously proud of you?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't want to speak for them, but yeah, I believe so. And
good answer.
You know, they've been very supportive, and God bless them. So
they never said, why are you doing this? Go become an accountant?
Well, I mean, they definitely were questioning at the beginning, but they were never opposed. It was never a battle or a struggle. They trusted me enough to make informed decisions, and I think they realized that college is very expensive, and higher education can put you into debt for a long period of time, and I really didn't have a passion to go at the moment because I just got rejected from West Point, and I think more parents can learn from that too. My parents just said, hey, if this is what you want to do, go do it, you know, and if you fail, then maybe you want to try something else, and I ended up working.
Well, so you didn't graduate from college, but you did receive an honorary doctorate from Liberty University, if I'm correct. right?
That's correct. Yes, never went to college, but I do have an honorary doctorate. So go figure that one out.
On top of that, you've written some books too. I mean, you've had top New York Times bestseller, I believe, the MAGA Doctrine, the only future that'll win the future, the only ideas that'll win the future, which was a hit. What do you think about the notion that? Well, obviously, you've already answered it, but let's go one step deeper into this because this fascinates me. What do you think of the idea that you have to go to college to make it in America? That, college is just a necessary step in the progression of a young person into adulthood. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think I talk about it quite often. In fact, my next book will probably be addressing just that in a pretty provocative way, which is, I think it's foolish and it's dangerous. I unless you have a very specific skill that you want to obtain, and I use my words very carefully always, but I'm using them especially carefully, skill. College should be about getting skills, not experiences, not friends, not connections, not a rite of passage, but a skill. And so, for example, we interview a lot of people here at Turning Point USA. I just did some interviews of young people, and I said, well, what's your skill? He said, well, I went to this school and I studied political science. I said, that's fine. What's your skill? What can you do that a high schooler can't do? And if most people that go to college can't answer that question. Now, when I talk to people that studied engineering or law, they say, well, I can write legal briefs. You're right. That's a really big deal. Like, you're right. That's something that I can't do. Or what's your skill? I can code if they went to a community college, or I can do carpentry. I can do plumbing. That's really the question that we need to start asking ourselves. Not where did you go, not what piece of paper do you have, but what skill do you have? Because skills are really the differentiation of a marketplace, and that's why certain professions pay higher than others. It's because when you have a skill that somebody else can't do, then all of a sudden there's a lack of supply of that labor, therefore the price or the cost that you are able to charge for your labor goes up, therefore wages go up. We haven't done that. We've done a very poor job of that in the last couple of decades. Instead, we have everyone go get a meaningless piece of paper, where they study something that doesn't matter with money they don't have to find jobs that don't exist. And that would answer a lot of the questions that people have about young people in this country can be traced back to that.
I happen to agree with you. I think that what you just said, you said it very clearly and you said it very, very well. And I wish more people understood that very, very well-made point. And that is a turning point, back to the name of your organization. If we come to a change of attitude about that, and perhaps we will with the current COVID situation that's setting higher education as well as all education on its ear, people are thinking of alternative ways to learn things and the idea of learning skills as opposed to having experiences. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I'm smiling ear to ear. I think that I think it's really a very, very good point. Let's back up a little bit. You talked about arguing politics and trashing the country. I'm sure this point has been brought up to you in debates if you've argued, and I'm sure you've had your number of political arguments, that part of being an American is the right and the process of dissenting, of criticizing the government, of pointing out the ills of a president or of a Congress or of anything having to do with the country. Where do you draw the line between good, honest criticism, even protest of wrongs and injustices and whatever, and trashing the country and being anti-American?
Yeah, I don't think anything in life is above criticism or above questioning or skepticism. And I say commonly, I think America has definitely made mistakes, but America is not a mistake. And so I draw the line very, very clearly as to, do you think the world's a better place because America exists? And if the answer is no, then you're definitely rooted in bitterness and anti-American sentiment. And also there's this other questions that you could definitely tell, and a lot of the American left embody this. Do you think America was illegally founded? Do you think that America's too powerful? And a lot of people on the left say yes when they are asked these questions, a lot. And so I think if you go a level deeper, the real question is, who are we as a country? What does it mean to actually be an American? And to put it as bluntly and as simply as I can, it is that if I work hard and play by the rules and I invest in the American way of life, which I like better than the American dream, I think the American dream is overused, the American way of life, am I going to see my life get a little bit better if I do the right thing? And the answer should, of course, be yes. And that has been a promise that has been given to every generation. It's now being put in jeopardy now. And so what we are seeing, though, over the last 5 to 10 years is instructed ingratitude, meaning young people have been taught to hate something that they really should have much more nuance or thankfulness or gratitude for or be thankful for. I mean, I talk to these 19-year-olds that have the opportunity to live in this unbelievably beautiful and abundant and opportunity-filled country, and it dominates their entire life. Their whole life is just complaining and being an activist. And it's a very unhappy way to live, but additionally, it's also very destructive for a country.
Let's talk about young people. And you're far more in touch with young people, being one of what's considered to be a young demographic, a young generation. You were the youngest speaker at the Republican National Convention, and that was duly noted. And even in the world of talk radio, you are a young player in terms of what we consider the big leagues. The general wisdom, the conventional wisdom, I don't know how true it is, but the conventional wisdom is that young people today, millennials and younger, are tending to the left, are tending to embrace ideas of liberalism, progressivism, and leftist as opposed to liberal. And then if you listen to Dennis Prager, you know the difference. And yet you're talking about thousands, millions of young people embracing your conservative message. What about young people in general? What is the state of young people? What should people of my generation or people 50 plus know that you know about young people in general today?
It's a great question. I mean, I think that conservatives get a lot wrong. I mean, I think they only – I think they use a single reason as to why young people are so upset and outraged in our country, and they say, well, we indoctrinated them and that they don't share our values. That's absolutely true. But the lockdowns, I think, will go down as one of the worst decisions in American history that disproportionately hurt young people. These one-size-fits-all lockdowns. It's very – look, there's a lot of economic and financial uncertainty happening with young people in our country right now, and I think conservatives generally really miss this. And we are flirting with a middle-class collapse that will result in America becoming unrecognizably radical very quickly. When young people can't afford a home, they can't afford to take out a mortgage – they graduated from a college with tens of thousands of dollars of student loan debt and incapable of finding meaningful work because 44% of even those that graduate are employed in jobs that don't require college degrees, so why'd they go in the first place? And only 59% of people that go to college graduate, so a lot of people that go to college drop out. You pair those two things together, the question should be, are these young people actually believing the system? Of course they're not. That's exactly why you're seeing this all come to kind of a collision point manifested through BLM Incorporated. And that's just the latest iteration of a grievance kind of culture that exists. And some of it's not actually that misplaced. There's a lot of valid criticism that there have been a sequence of public policy decisions to to jeopardize a lot of young people's capacity to succeed and to flourish in our country. And so, look, we are flirting with right now in our country a potential revolt with people under the age of 35, the likes of which most people in the political class don't recognize or realize. I don't support it, but that's just the landscape as it is right now.
Huh. You mentioned BLM Incorporated. Are you saying that there's a difference between the race relations, the equality, the reckoning movement, and the organization that appears to be behind it?
Yeah, I mean, look, the organization should be, I think, completely and totally denounced and repudiated. I don't really know what the equality movement strives to achieve, so I'm not going to attack or mislabel that, but I'm happy to, you know, talk to any person that would want to interface on it. But yeah, the organization itself is very shady, very shadowy, and also stands for the abolishment of police, prisons, legalization of sex work, and also the destruction of the Western prescribed nuclear family. That's not an organization I'd put my name behind.
Mm. You have put your name behind Donald Trump, and I understand why, and you've explained that. However, my own personal view, and I'm sharing that only so you have a little insight into where I'm coming from with these questions, is that I'm skeptical of all politicians. I try to separate ideology, character, reality from really giving my heart to any politician or political party. That's just me. Although it eventually is a binary choice, and you got to go one way or the other, because that's what a country is about, and that's what consensus is about, and that's what compromise is about. So it's very complicated. But do you ever worry that Trump will let you down? Or do you ever find yourself saying, if I had his ear this minute, here's what I would tell him to do. He'd be better off and we'd be better off. What are your thoughts about Trump as a person who you have endorsed and at this time is such a major focal point of what you stand for?
Yeah, I mean, he's a friend of mine, so I probably won't. I kind of make a policy not to say anything negative about friends of mine publicly or privately. And so whether I agree or disagree on everything he does, I don't really consider that to be a, you know, a functioning role of kind of my relationship, you know, and how I operate on that. But I will say this, look, I share your view that most politicians are liars and deceiving and thieves, quite honestly, and in both political parties. And I think the Washington, D.C. cartel has made a bipartisan consensus to sell out our country to the Chinese Communist Party and keep our borders open and to make a sequence and a series of decisions that have really harmed working people in our country. And I think President Trump is one of the only, if not the first presidential candidate to effectively pinpoint this anxiety and this angst in a way that, you know, middle-income people can actually feel as if they have a voice. And so as far as letting me down, I mean, he has done everything he said he was going to do with the courts on foreign policy, on renegotiating trade deals. And so I am more than pleased to see the results he's delivered for our country. And I will say this, that I've had the opportunity to meet numerous senators. I've had the opportunity to, you know, meet plenty of members of Congress. And President Trump treats me with far more kind of, I don't want to say respect, but with a lot more intentionality of what I have to say and things that I might have experienced to be able to communicate to him than even most members of kind of the, you know, congressional intelligentsia, if you will. And that says a lot about who he is as a person. And for that, I will continue. And for that and for much more, I'll continue to advocate on his behalf and do everything we can to try to get him reelected.
Final question. And this is just more my own curiosity as a media person and an event organizer. So what was it like being a speaker at the Republican National Convention, which this year was such a even the Democratic National Convention were so different than any convention before. What was it like behind the scenes, and when you eventually made that speech, did it feel strange? What was it like?
Yeah, it was incredible. So I decided to tape my speech in advance, which is I've said that publicly before. So, but I didn't know I was going to lead off the convention, so that was kind of interesting. And we did it in one take, so you had the opportunity to do it more than once, and just stepped right up there. I did one rehearsal without the cameras running, and I did one take, and there you go. That was it. And so I tried to fit a lot into a couple minutes, and I think I made some good arguments. I pored over that speech, and what started as, oh, Charlie, you have 7 minutes, got whittled down to you got 2 minutes and 45 seconds. So definitely got better at editing and speeding up my speech without being too fast. And what an amazing opportunity, honor, and blessing. And so it was something that I'll treasure for the rest of my life, and very thankful to have been given that platform.
And there you have it, an uninterrupted conversation with the founder of Turning Point USA and the host of a new midday talk show on the Salem Radio Network, Charlie Kirk. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find the show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Rap, check out mhwrap.com. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a presentation of Podcast One, produced in association with Talkers Magazine and Good Phone Communications. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved.